in the award-winning Fat Wallet Show this week, the Zach One Lap Index.
Yay!
Finally. I'm Christia, with me as always Simon, and for the second time, 1 year on to the day, Zach Besaidenhout, welcome, welcome.
Great, thanks. Good to be here.
So if you're new to this podcast, please be warned that a bleep version of the show is available on justonelap.com. Thank you so much to Sean Combrink for making that happen for us. So Zach, I have to admit, I got you here under false pretenses. I said that we were going to kill the listener lover index, but then yesterday, Lesa Khisha, our friend, wrote us, and he had some concerns about us killing the index, and I think he makes some really good points. So now we have a race. He says, I don't mind that you're killing the index, but a few positive lessons can really be learned from it. Although it's been down 5% on average and around 10% lately, just to contextualize, it's down 12% today. Hurrah.
Ex-dividends. We haven't put dividends back in.
It's still a good example of diversification, considering how far down Pallinghurst, Highmark, Ashton and Harman and Steinhoff have been. Shares like Kumba that are up by really healthy margins, excluding dividends, are a good testament that there are some good picks, which easily could have been missed and we wouldn't know that someone can pick it. My main qualm and lesson, I guess, is that we are killing it after just 1 year. Typically, a market cycle lasts about 7 years. Case in point, your ETF portfolio that's flat for over 3 or 4. Thanks for reminding me of that, Lesa Khisha. I thought we were friends. So it makes sense that over a one-year period, a self-picked portfolio is underperforming. It may seem like a trivial point, but there is magic in it. The law of probability and averages says that the method we used will underperform over half the time and then overperform the other half, giving us an average return over the market cycle. I concede there's no telling at which point the cycle we enter, at which point in the cycle we entered, so it could get worse before it gets better, or it could really just go bad. Alternatively, it could really just go good. Equally, it can shoot the lights out, he says. The most important variable then becomes time. The Love Index shows that by our nature, we are impatient with our stock investments. We're impatient with our stock investments if we can ditch them after a year. Arguably, most of us had given up months ago. That's true, I did. While we can put up with a bad pension fund or retirement annuity to retirement, I think we measured a long-distance runners using a 100-meter stopwatch. I would have loved to see how the index performs for a longer period, minimum 5 to 7 years, and I probably will be tracking it on the side personally. I'm almost certain the dogs in the portfolio won't recover, but a lot of the goodish companies will outperform the markets, especially if dividends are factored.
No, his point's 100%. And
giving us a hiding.
Yeah, and some points. If this was a more managed portfolio, for example, the Steinhoffs, we might have bailed at some point. We wouldn't be sitting in it at $1.99, put it that way, although our entry was $65.90. So we would be less underwater. And we've got some decent performers here.
So I was thinking maybe today, in addition to creating a new index, we could talk about how we would rebalance this index to get rid of the real dogs, which have been Pallinghurst. Like I was very skeptical of Santova coming in, but it's actually like our second best performer. Pallinghurst and Steinhoff especially have been, and Purple Group, which are the giant rating.
Pallinghurst is only down 20%. I mean, I know only, but, you know, in the big picture of things. I mean, Steinhoff is the one down 96.98, Purple down 45, and Blue down 47.
And Gem...
Gemfields is only off 21. Yeah. That's almost winning in the current market.
Oh, my goodness. That's too depressing.
So, right. But to rebalance this would surely be easy, right? Because this is an index of love, and if you're down 40%, there's no more love left.
So we did mention that we have to, when we put together this index, Zach mentioned there's a committee that monitors this sort of thing all the time, and there's like daily monitoring of indices. We have not done that. Yeah. So if we did, would Steinhoff already have fallen out?
Yeah, I think from a love perspective, how we put this together is obviously this was listeners obviously giving their views of which are their favorite stocks or the stocks that they love. So I don't think that Steinhoff is currently on the top of the list of a stock that everybody loves.
Oh, that's true. So, our methodology is just whether we like it or not.
Exactly. So again, if you need to divorce, we can kick out Steinhoff if that's the viewer's opinion. But yeah, there's definitely scope to remove companies that's no longer being loved. In the indexed.
So considering that people nominated companies, do the people who nominated their companies get to
unnominate
them? Or do we just get votes for new companies? Well, we get to decide that.
I would say that it's you can open this up again for sort of a next round of stocks that's loved. It doesn't need to be the exact same people that gave the previous votes. But again, if there's a new view of a listener group, new listeners that you have, and they feel that some other stocks need to be in this index, that's basically the love that's coming through from them now to make some changes to the index.
But then how is this different from what Lesegisha was saying? Because if we say, okay, well, these stocks are performing poorly, let's kick them out and add new ones, then we are doing what he's saying, which is just like, you know, pivoting after one year.
But then we're doing an actively managed portfolio, which is what the fund managers do, where they run along and they boot stuff. And you know, and you would look at Blue Label down 46.5%, and someone might say, well, now it's value. some people might even say Steinhoff at $1.99 is now its value. But it is, yeah, it's a distinction. And we have to remember that the fund managers have a benefit to us as individuals and our portfolios that they don't pay tax internally. So with my long-term portfolio, I need to ideally hold 3 years. So I've only got a CGT liability, not an income tax liability. The fund manager doesn't have that concern. They've also, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So are we being fund managers or are we being long-term
index providers?
Well, all that. I'm not sure we're being that.
Yeah, I think the thing is that you need to remain true to
the philosophy
of the index. If it's a market cap index, you need to go with the larger stocks. If it's a value index, you go with sort of the value metrics that came through, and those are the companies that's going to go in or go out. Again, yeah, if this is the view of which stocks people love, then those need to be currently reflected in the index. We can't hold on to things that we don't no longer love anymore and just keep them in the index.
But that's a great point, to keep to the philosophy, which was we invite the listeners to do it. That's our philosophy for good or for 12% down.
We should have discussed maybe when we put together the index when things fall out. Like maybe there should have been because now we can't replace all of them because then we have an actively managed fund.
Well, except that our methodology was love and we asked our listeners to suggest, so we would stick to that same methodology and ask them to suggest again.
Well, maybe what we could do is just kick out the ones that are negative today.
remove the one that we hate now.
Yes. But, yeah.
Except
I mean,
that,
it stands
but
to reason,
now we're
right?
changing the rules in midstream. The rules were listeners choose. Now, listeners choose unless Christia says otherwise.
No, they'll choose the replacements. I'm just saying, how do we decide which ones to kick out?
So, yeah, okay, do we just start afresh? Because, like, for example, mine was Discovery. So I'm like, nah, Discovery can stay.
Well, Discovery is not negative today. What is negative? PSG Group, Purple Group, Blue Telecom, Blue Label Telecoms, MTN, Bright.
Lewis, Tiger, Lewis, famous.
Lewis was Lesegisha's contribution.
And remember JC. That some of these companies could be hammered, but they could still be loved. They could still be companies that people
true.
Love. It doesn't mean that the performance is down, that they don't love them. There's obviously certain companies in there that we really don't love anymore. But some of them are probably companies that we still love, even though the performance are down.
That's
a good
point.
What about if we vote for the ones to remove?
Okay. I mean, to me, it's Steinhoff.
Well, yeah, Steinhoff, obviously.
How many votes? Because I'd like to remove Chemfields, too.
That's a good question. What if we say if we get 17 votes, because there are 17 shares, for a single share, it goes out?
Yo. Okay, that's a lot.
It's a lot.
That's onerous. Okay.
All right. Zach, I wanted to ask you a question. I heard the other day that if you switch on the Satrix Now platform, I don't know if you'll know this actually, if you switch on the Satrix Now platform between unit trusts, you don't trigger a capital gains event. Is that correct?
Ooh, I actually don't know that. We'll need to get Satrix to answer for us in that space. I know that there's some changes within regulation that even if you actually now change securities within a fund, that there might be capital gains being triggered. So that's some of the new things that the regulator is looking at. So I think that type of freebie being available in the market is probably going to disappear if regulation has its way.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah, it's to the point we've made often, is that, you know, what SOS does best is close loopholes. And they've spent 20 years closing them.
Look, if that's not a loophole that they're thinking of closing, that is really something you should consider if you're looking at trading, like a more active portfolio, because you don't trigger tax events.
Are they not perhaps talking about being within a within a tax free?
Yeah.
No.
Not.
Okay. Because you sell units. You don't actually ever take ownership of the money. So you have your money with the unit trust provider. They buy units of this and then buy units of that. It's not like they necessarily have to sell these units to buy those units with your money. So you can shift around within a UT without actually triggering capital gains.
Yeah, I think the traditional way of how we get away with capital gains is within that ETF is if there's no capital gains tax within the ETF's fund management. But the moment that you sell those units and buy new units, it's obviously being triggered. So I think the only way that Satrix and I could probably get away with this is if they actually get the whole platform to be seen as one sort of fund.
Oh.
So if that is what's been done, then it could be possible. But I think that those type of things are definitely being looked at from SARS perspective, so that you actually pay the capital gains when you buy and sell securities or funds.
Going forward. And that has a huge implication for the asset management industry, and basically it levels the playing field, which in one sense is great. I would rather level the playing field the other way, where SARS says, look, as long as your money stays within this account, I don't charge you tax until you take it out.
Mm.
I appreciate the complexities around it, but they're leveling it against us rather than in favor of us. And the reason they're doing it is because, hey,
they need
revenue.
The money. Yeah. So I was reading this morning, Absa did this fantastic article on how the fuel price is put together. I actually shared it on Twitter. You guys can go find it there if you want to see it. But the levies we pay on fuel makes up 6% of the government's income every year. Mm. Isn't that astronomical?
Mm.
So huge. Mm-hmm. All right. So, Zach, the reason actually why we asked you to come is, like, obviously we can't be trusted to put together an index. So so why don't you talk to us about, like, making the index makers index? Like, if you had there were no regulatory limitations and you could just do whatever you want, what would you do?
Yeah, I didn't think about this. And I must say I've become sort of a benchmark hugger myself, but let's call this now an active manager hugger in a way as well, because I think a lot of investors' money is still invested into active strategies. And one thing that I think the ETF providers and index tracker fund managers have struggled to is actually to try and convince investors to move away from these active strategies into index-like strategies or index-linked strategies. So the first thing that I had to look at for us is to say, well, let's go and find the sort of the seven biggest equity funds in the market. Okay, so that
are you doing a fund of funds?
No. This was just the starting point, where is the money and how is the money currently being invested in South Africa?
Okay.
So within those seven active manager funds from seven different asset managers, we can see that there's probably about 130 billion rand currently in those equity unit trusts, South African unit trusts. And I went to go and look then to their top 10 holdings to see how much of overlap is actually between all of them and how much overlap is actually between the active managers and, say, a top 10 within a market cap index.
Ooh, how cool that you have access to all this data.
No, it's really available. You can just go into the fact sheets of all of the active managers and our fact sheet on our website. But what I found, interestingly, is that a company like Naspers, on average of those seven fund managers, was sitting around 12.5%. So
and this is the company that all of the active managers complain about having too much exposure to.
So, yes, Naspers could be up to 20% in a unconstrained equity index, like an all-share index or a SWIX index. But again, the fund managers still, all of them, all seven of them held Naspers at around 12%, some a little bit higher, some a bit lower. Some managers even going over 15% in Naspers in those top seven. But also,
did you do top seven by assets under management or performance?
Assets under management.
Okay.
So these are the biggest, this is where the money is currently invested. So if you invested in any of the seven biggest equity funds in South Africa, you have exposure to Naspers.
Okay.
That's basically, and on average about 12.5%. One of the fund managers actually held all 10 of the top largest 10 companies in the index. So their top 10 holdings were the top 10 holdings of an index.
In what weighting did the weightings
reflect? It differed slightly here and there, but it was surprising that they didn't even remove a single company from the top 10 in the index. Another very popular
one. Somebody
else
did all the work for them. So
this led me to say, well, if the fund managers like the top 10 holdings so much, then why shouldn't the index have those top 10 holdings as a core?
Mm-hmm.
So, or even the top 20 companies. So the top 10 within an index environment market cap probably represents about 60% of our South African stock exchange universe, or the JSE. If you go down to about 20 stocks, we end up around 75%.
Sure.
So I thought, well, a very good starting point for then the index is this almost active manager popularity, because they back those companies. But also, this is where the current money is. This is the large companies. This is where the bulk of the assets are invested. So
yeah,
you do need these companies in the index, either from a benchmark point of view or just where the liquidity and tradability as well. So I thought, well, my starting universe is going to be, I'm going to select the top 20 universe from a size point of view. In the universe, and that gives me about 75%.
And that's your index hugging. You with 20 stocks, you've almost got the benchmark in
correct
its entirety.
Yeah, because if we look at active managers today and an active equity fund that investors might be invested in, they currently sit around 20 companies or 30 companies,
mm-hmm.
20 and 30 companies, and a lot of the smart beta ETFs and funds that we see out there as well, they also end up with about 25 to 30 companies. So that's a really good investable universe, and you can still get quite a lot of diversification through that whole process with about that number of companies. So I said, well, let's get a good core in place. So the top 20% or top 20 companies will make up about 75% of the universe.
Can I just interrupt you there? A while back, I saw you speak somewhere, and you said something about the difference between a benchmark and a fund objective. Can you maybe just discuss that quickly?
Yeah, so a lot of investors have an objective that they want to meet. So if you want to invest for your child's education, or if you want sort of a short-term investment for a quick buck that because you're looking for a new iPhone, or you're looking for a pension fund, or you want to keep up with inflation. So there's different needs of people, and that would also depend on what their objective will be. Is if it's a CPI plus something, they want to outperform inflation, then that would typically be their objective. But it doesn't mean that that is the benchmark that they would give a fund manager to manage the money in line with. Obviously, the objective is to beat inflation, but if the available universe of investable stocks that the fund manager can access can also be accessed through indexation or an index tracking product, then there's also that type of a benchmark that you need to give an active manager.
So if I look at a fact sheet of an ETF, and the fact sheet says the benchmark is, or of a fund, maybe not an ETF, the fact sheet says the benchmark is CPI plus 3, that's actually not
enough. It's not the benchmark.
That's not enough information. Like, they should tell me compared to, like, what are they comparing their own performance to?
Correct.
Okay.
So that CPI is typically the objective of the fund or the investor, is I want inflation plus a little bit more.
So what mm-hmm. would your fund's benchmark be? So the Listener Love Index.
So the Listener Love Index would probably default back to sort of an all-share index or a market cap index, because we can really pick any of those companies on the JSE to be included in the Love Index as a benchmark. Again, I don't think we've really thought about an objective for the index, probably just to outperform, like, almost a momentum strategy, because everybody loves these stocks. Everybody thinks these are the stocks that's going to go up, or the companies that we love. So we could even default back to sort of a momentum index as a default for love index.
And for yours?
For mine, I would also say that we probably want to go back to sort of a market cap index, because at the end of the day, that is the the full universe of stocks that you can pick from. Mm. I know in South Africa we have a whole range of different market cap indices or SWIX indices, and a lot of confusion regarding which one should investors be looking at or pension funds be looking at, either from an all-share index, a SWIX index, a capped version of all of these. And do I only need to look at sort of the large cap companies? How important is the mid and small cap space? I think the traditional way of looking at this globally, and I think that's why my competitors like MSCI is a popular benchmark globally as well, is because it does reflect the true size and availability of stocks out there. And those market cap benchmarks are still very popular.
And in a sense, the market cap benchmark is a love index, because it's the market has, you know, pushed NASPAS to the biggest stock in our indices because the market loved NASPAS.
Right.
Yeah.
Can you maybe explain, speaking of the mid-cap index, how the top 40 index methodology has changed to suddenly, why is there suddenly overlap between mid-cap and top 40?
Yeah, so those are competitors' indices. But they have looked at that from, again, maybe defaulting back to the traditional way of how the popular index providers like ourselves, FTSE and MSCI, has looked at the universe to say, well, the top 75% of the universe is typically referred to as sort of the large cap space. And then the next 10%, sort of 15%, the sort of the mid cap space, and then you end up with the small caps as well. So I think that the JSE and FTSE has probably looked at that type of methodology or construction in the universe, and that's why there might now be a bit of overlap.
Oh, okay.
As well. Yeah. The South African market is also very small compared to global markets, so we can't always just apply that 75-85 type of rule to our markets. Mm. I think historically the top 40 companies were the large liquid companies. So when we brought out our S&P South Africa 50 5 years ago, we again looked at the size and liquidity and said, well, we actually think that the top 50 actually makes sense from a large liquid basket of core holdings.
And that C-top 50 is a capped as well, is it not?
Correct, yeah. So I think once we've looked at the universe, we said, well, single stock risk might become an issue as well with NASPAS growing so rapidly. And it basically took a year for NASPAS to start hitting that cap. So most of our indices are actually now capped. We launched the first SWIX capped index. We have the top 50 index that's capped. And most of our smart beta indices are also capped. And looking back to these active manager funds, you can see that most of them are reluctant to really go over 10-15% in a single security. And
what's been really interesting for me, I've been redoing the ETF blog that we do on justonelap.com. So I started that blog in 2016 looking at individual ETFs. And it's been really interesting to me because I forgot back in 2016, SAB Miller was the biggest holding on the top 40. And I remember back then how anxious people were about the holding in SAB Miller and about the fact that they've fallen out of the index, and more recently with Steinhoff. And it's just it's been a good reminder of why we choose ETFs over different kinds of investments, because like either they're capped, as in your case, or they just fall out of the index, and it tends to be a relatively painless process. Having said that, I've never made any money, so maybe I should shut up.
But if we go back 10 years, or a little more, 11 years ago to 2007, we were having the same conversation as an industry, but the difference was the stocks we were worried about was BHP Billiton, Anglo, Kumba, Anglo Platinum. Mm. And if we go back 10 years before that, again, same conversation, but then it was Didata and CompuServe and DataTech. And, and over that 20-odd year period, we've had tech was big, and then it was
mining materials
and stuff, and now it's China.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, it's amazing how these work. Okay, all right, so back to your index, sorry.
Yeah, maybe just to touch on that last point there is on that materials issue is, and why we have sort of the SWIX index in the market today is because we were sitting at 50% plus in just mining and material companies 10 years ago or 15 years ago. And so the industry came up with a new index called the SWIX. And there we stripped out the foreign holdings or foreign ownership of these companies out of that, out of those companies, and created SWIX. Today, SWIX is no longer really relevant, in my view, because materials is no longer dominating the index or the universe as it did 15 years ago. Where we really are seeing interest is in capped indices. Single stock risk is a big issue today within the South African environment, either looking at NASPAS or any other company that might be dominating or have too much exposure for investors when something goes horribly wrong, how much of a pain can they actually handle in
the index? Is this a really big issue for us because we have so few? Because when you look at companies like Apple and Amazon, and I mean, they are also just gigantic companies,
yep,
but because there are so many stocks in the index, they never take up such a big space.
Correct. So in the case of Apple, over $1 trillion, and it only represents less than 4% of the S&P 500. So that's just the large caps of U.S. companies. If you throw the whole universe in there, that 4% goes down a little bit more. But again, if you can't put a $1 trillion company in the South African market, it would be 99% of the universe.
So technically, if we had, let's say we had a listing boom of note and we could add another 400 companies to the top 40, that would be another way of reducing that single stock risk.
Correct. The more stocks that you have in a portfolio, the better the diversification, and the less single stock risk that you end up with having in your portfolio.
But it's almost, aside from the S&P 500, if you look around the world, all indices suffer from concentration risk. And there was research I saw that if you took the quarter top stocks, which in our case is 10, Zach's numbers is 65%. If you look at Italy, it's 70. If you look at India, it's 92%. You know, we're actually sort of in the bottomish range of concentration, with the US being the single exception, where those top, in the case of the US, would be 125 stocks in the S&P 500, having an outsize. But even those 125 in the S&P are more than half of the index.
So I'm thinking from a shareholder perspective in my individual portfolio, technically I could manage this risk as well just by adding more ETFs that have larger holdings, right? So if I'm concerned about Naspers being over a quarter of my local holdings, but I add the Ashburton 1200, then suddenly Naspers becomes a smaller part of my overall portfolio, and that's a way for me to manage that risk individually.
Correct, yeah. So, again, there's lots of way to sort of dilute those heavy overweight positions in single stocks and adding different themes and styles of investing as well, adding dividends or quality ETFs, low volatility ETFs or international ETFs to that basket of ETFs that you are holding. And that will bring down your single stock risk in any of those single big holdings in a big ETF.
Interesting. All right.
Great. By doing that top 20 screening, we obviously need to be cognizant of sector exposures as well, because we might be taking the top 20 companies, but they really only represent, say, 5 or 6 sectors, and we can actually have 9 sectors where we can get some revenue and returns from. So by looking at that, we were slightly underweight consumer staples. We also were slightly overweight property stocks or real estate companies. And then healthcare and energy were some of the stocks that we were slightly underweight, and obviously some of the material and other companies were sort of dominating sort of on the larger scale. So in order for us to become, again, a bit more market neutral or market cap neutral, we need to go and find these companies that are missing within the portfolio so that we actually look at all the sectors in the universe. And again, if you want to use this as a benchmark, you need to attribute your holdings for a medical aid, or not a medical aid, a healthcare company against a healthcare stock. So we need to add some of those stocks into the universe.
But why would we have to add that? Because, like, if you've chosen top 20 by market cap, shouldn't that just be like if the other companies do better, they come in, and if they do worse, they go out?
Yes, on the top 20 universe, that's fine. But remember, we do have access to the full JSE stock. So, and there are other sectors that we also need to represent.
Okay, so you're just using the top 20 as like a starting
block. Universe. Okay. That's a good core. It's a solid core that gives you about 75% exposure to the JSE. But then looking at that, we need to go and find these other sectors as well. And one way of doing that is we can, again, try and go and find these companies or missing sectors from a market cap point of view, go and try and find the biggest ones that are missing in the healthcare sectors or so on. or we can actually try and become a little bit more clever and add maybe some other ideas into the index construction by looking at companies that pay good dividends. So okay. there's some dividend protection also being built into to the
You're
index.
You're making us a smart beta index, aren't you?
So there's a little bit of a, so say 75% core market cap, and then we'll add a bit of a 25% smart beta component to that. And I think that's a very good strategy for any pension fund or investor to really consider as well. Because typically the smart beta components or active strategies that you want to put around a very solid market cap core, you pay a little bit more for them. So, and you don't want to blow your whole budget on that. So a 25% exposure, I think, is a good...
Can you explain why you pay more for them?
So technically there is a lot of... So in the active management space, they have to employ quite a lot of clever people to do financial... to look at financial ratios and financial statements and do due diligence regarding ESG and all other factors these days. So there is a cost involved in trying to find this extra alpha component out of the normal market cap universe that we can look at. And again, with index providers, we also need to pay for access to that fundamental data ratio. So we use various vendors like Reuters and FactSet, and we've got a company Market Intelligence. And you even need to go and look at the financial statements. So there's a lot of work in trying to find these fundamental ratios and then coming up with the methodologies of constructing a smart beta methodology, because it's not saying, well, we've got the access, now how are we going to put this together and call it smart beta? So there's definitions that need to be looked at to come up with quality methodology, momentum methodology, dividend methodology.
Can an index provider change their smart beta methodology without declaring it? Like if you, let's say there's like a small element of the dividend strategy that changes, can you do that internally?
A few years ago you could. These days you can't. Regulations really clamp down on indexation or index providers as well. So we have European benchmark regulation that's pretty big in the in Europe now. EASCA compliancy that we need to adhere to. So the process really is when we need to change anything in even our market cap indices, there's typically a market consultation that we make the market aware that we want to change this and give sort of recommendations of what we want to change and why we want to change. The market would then respond to that consultation, and the index committee will then review all of the feedback and then only make the change.
And when you say the market responds, is it the ETF providers, the product providers, or like the market like me?
So the market like you, the normal guy in the street, can also give input into that. So the consultation is usually available on our websites for anybody to respond to that. But obviously the big ETF providers and users of the index, obviously, again, their view is more important for us to really get their feedback. But it's not to say that we will only listen to their feedback.
Mm, that's interesting. Okay.
Great. Yeah, so what I thought is I like the sort of dividend strategies. And then I also like this new idea that index providers have been playing around with and it's becoming very popular in multi-factor. So, and this is where we combine quality, momentum, and value investing into a single index. Now, we've launched an index called a QVM, or Quality Value Momentum Index, for South Africa. So I thought, let's go and look at that universe to see if we can find some of these missing sectors, as well as the Dividend Aristocrats index that we run, to see if we can find some of the missing sectors to include there. So obviously there could be a lot of overlap, again, from the top 20 companies that we've seen. So we really want to avoid doubling up on the top 20. So we're going to find companies in the missing sectors, but also then maybe add one or two from those companies that has scored very high in the QVM factor or dividend factor to complete the last 25%. So within the healthcare sector, again, you have sort of three healthcare companies that you can add in that space that also give you good dividends. So Netcare and Mediclinic, again, really good companies on the dividend side. But again, if you're looking at the QVM approach, Adcock Ingrams also qualifies in there. So again, we can look to add those companies. We're also missing energy. So Exxaro Resources currently is also in the QVM index to be included there. And then we also need to add some consumer staple companies, and these are typically some of your retailers, but Spar, Clicks, Pick and Pay, they all come through within the QVM approach. Now, the why I like the QVM approach is because we're looking for quality companies, which means they are profitable, they're not highly leveraged, and they aren't cooking their books, so their accrual ratios look really good as well. So those are good companies to look at as well. And in tough market conditions as well, these companies typically sit on a little bit more cash, so they can sustain some of the fluctuations that we see in the market and maybe merge or buy other companies to grow through sort of difficult periods. Dividend strategies as well. If you've got good dividends to pay out, you're probably sitting on a bit of earnings. So again, you can sort of use some of that to buy other companies or grow the company during difficult periods. So that's why I like to add some of those companies in the universe.
And so in total, how many have we got?
So the aim is to have about 30 companies.
30, yeah. All right. Cool. So shall we go through them?
Seven. Yeah, so that takes us to 27.
Yeah. So again, on the dividend side, we can obviously add a few year in there as well, just to complete the top 30 universe. I didn't complete a full 30 universe for us to sort of look at that, but I can complete that and we can add it on to the publications.
Okay, perfect. All right. So what are we looking at in top 20? So we're just basically, if somebody's listening and they want to do this themselves, they could go and just look at a top 40 index and then pick the 20 first ones, right? Because those are just by market capitalization.
So it's NASPAS, Billiton, Richemont, Anglo, Sasol, Standard, First Rand, BTI, MTN, Old Mutual, Mondi, Sunlam, Absa, Remgro, Aspen, Bidcorp, ShopRite, Vodacom, GrowthPoint, Bidvest, Investec.
Great.
Investec PLC.
Yeah. I've never understood that. Why are there so many Investecs?
Because when you wanted to go offshore at one time, you could, and then at one time you couldn't. So what you did was you created a local and an offshore company which both had control over the same assets. Just because, hey, complexity.
Mondi is another one.
Yeah,
so Investec and Mondi are
the only two, hey? Yeah. Whereas others like Old Mutual just went to London and became primary listed in London and then came home. But aside from that, and then that happened in the late 90s, and then suddenly in like early 2000s and stuff, it was like no longer cool.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So, and then we've got the
MediClinics, Netcares, Spar. Mm-hmm. We can also look to include the likes of a Distell, Exaro, Adcock. And then we were short a property company as well. So actually one that comes through is Resilient. The REIT of Resilient can also be added.
Oh, didn't you say we were overweight property companies?
No, we were underweight.
Underweight. Yeah. Oh, I was just going to say, because I know that property has been struggling lately.
Yeah, so the only property we had was GrowthPoint.
Yeah.
In the 20 from the top 40.
Correct. Yeah.
Somebody mentioned to me on Twitter the other day, they buy the Dividend Aristocrats, the local one, and the dividend payments have become smaller and smaller over time. And could you maybe talk about like what happens to dividend paying companies when the market struggles overall?
So when the market struggles overall, or the economy in general struggles overall, you'd see that obviously the dividends that companies pay out would become less.
Is that because of what you said earlier, like they use that money to sustain the company and grow the company in difficult times?
If they feel they need to do that, they can obviously do that. They can sort of dip into that sort of earnings pool and use it for other expansion in the company instead of paying it out to the shareholders. The nice thing about the Dividend Aristocrats is it only includes companies that can continue to grow their dividends. Mm-hmm. So if a company feels that they need to reduce their dividend or drop the dividend completely, that company will be removed out of the Dividend Aristocrats methodology.
But what if there's no companies to take its place?
So we still have quite a lot of them to include in the universe. At a stage, we were sort of short only about 20 companies that could do that. I think the last time...
And then does the index just become smaller?
It just becomes a 20 stock universe, yes, because it wants to remain true to the methodology, just like we want to be true to the Love Index. Yeah. We need to just remain true to that. We can look to obviously interact with the market to say, well, currently the methodology for inclusion might be a little bit strict, or it could be too relaxed and we need to... make it more difficult to include stocks. And we have done this about 2 or 3 years ago in the Dividend Aristocrat, because the initial rule was to say that we only need 5 years of growing dividends to be included in the universe. And then suddenly, sort of after 2008, 5 years later, all of the companies started paying dividends again for 5 years in a row. So we suddenly had a boom of companies that now qualify. So we said, well, because we now have so many, we can actually increase the criteria.
That's right. So you pushed it to seven.
We pushed it to seven.
Do you see in the local Dividend Aristocrats the same thing that you do with the offshore? So I know if you buy the S&P 500 and you buy the global dividends, they are a really good, like the Dividend Aristocrats is almost like a stabilizer for the S&P 500 because it doesn't include all those big tech stocks because of that. Does the same apply to the South African market or not as cleanly?
So in the South African universe, we excluded any property companies as well. So that's one sector that we immediately
eliminated. Is that because of REIT legislation?
And because a lot of the property companies would just qualify because they just have all this rental income that they have to pay out, and it will be seen as dividends. So you don't want to end up having a dividend index that really looks
actually
like
a property index.
Yeah.
So that's really where you want to distinguish between what is a real estate or property sector fund or ETF and what is a dividend-focused index. A nice thing about the S&P 500 and why it's actually a good add-on to an index like this or a core index is because we are missing some of the big tech companies in the South African universe. We don't have an Apple and a Microsoft and those type of companies listed on the JSE. So adding sort of those big tech companies from US exposure really adds from a diversification point of view within your portfolio.
But do you think that the dividend index is kind of a stabilizer for the top 40, the local Dividend Aristocrats and the top 40? Because in the S&P 500, you've got the big tech companies at the top of the S&P 500, but in the Dividend Aristocrats index, you don't have the tech companies because they're not old enough. It's almost like an inverse index.
Yeah, I wouldn't really just focus really on the tech side of things, but I think that the Dividend Aristocrats or dividend strategies in general is a very good stabilizer for your top 50 or top 40 exposure as well, is because when something goes down, when the market goes down, these dividend paying companies will remain to pay out dividends and increasing dividends over years. So there is this sort of stability that they would bring into your return profile as well.
Do you think that companies continue to pay dividends to stay in the index? Is there any like benefit for them to do that?
I think if there's a lot of money following a particular ETF or strategy, yes, then it is. And we've seen this with sort of ESG indices as well. There is popular indices that some companies really want to be in that index from a sort of a bragging rights perspective. But I doubt that it is sort of the only thing that companies would focus on to say, well, I have to pay a dividend because I need to be in the index or the ETF.
But
yeah.
What about
sometimes they just bust. I mean, General Electric paid a dividend for, 80 years and then frankly just had no money
left. But what about in the local context, what about a small cap company that has no liquidity, that struggles with liquidity, that would directly benefit from being included in an index because the market maker is always buying the shares?
Yeah, I think the ETF industry in South Africa or the index business in South Africa is still very small relative to global popularity. The active management strategies are still dominating in South Africa, not because of their performance, by the way. But I think it's more important for the management of that small company to really show to all investors, stakeholders, and active managers and fund managers to say, well, this is what we can deliver and not just focus on, I need to pay a quick buck of a dividend so I can be in the index now. And maybe because they paid that dividend, they can't pay next year or they go bust the next year.
If a company I had was paying dividends to stay in Zacks index, I would be deeply worried.
Yeah, but you wouldn't know.
You would look at it and think, how do they afford that dividend? I mean, some companies have progressive dividends where, so typically a dividend is you pay a percentage of profit and that's how you run it. Some companies, MTN does it, Sasol did it for a while, where they promise that the dividend will go up 15% every year, and every time they run into problems.
And it's important to look at dividend investing in general, because sometimes when companies are really feeling the pressure, they might do a little bit of a quick trick to say, oh, we're going to pay a dividend now just to get some interest. But that's actually a warning sign as well. So that's why in the Dividend Aristocrats Index, we say you need to do this for 7 years in a row before we include you. It's not just a quick fix and then maybe something goes bust. So a lot of the other competitors have an index where they look at the forecast of analysts, which they expect going paying dividends. So you might expect a failing company to pay a quick dividend over a short-term period, but you need to be careful because that company could go bust like an Able the next year.
Yeah, I mean, that index was full of Able, PPC, Kumba, and those share prices got somewhere between decimated and decimated.
And what about... So when I went on this whole thing a while back about companies only paying dividends when they feel like it, because it seems to me like that's something that should be regulated. Like, you know, somebody is investing in your company, you should share the profit, right? And then the biggest pushback I got on that is if companies are paying dividends, they're not reinvesting that money into growing their company. So wouldn't a dividend aristocrat strategy kind of run the risk of investing in companies that have just given up on growth?
No, because I think the investors can be rewarded in two ways. It's obviously being paid out the dividend in the one end, and increasing dividends is nice as well to have. But again, if there is sort of no real growth prospects, why should the company just hold on to the cash if they can pay it out?
Yeah, and in the US, you get the utility sector, which we don't have in South Africa, power, water, and those are largely ex-growth. I mean, their growth is maybe GDP, but you buy them because they've got chunky dividends. And what you don't want is a power plant going off and buying a vegetable grocer and trying to become jack of all trades. You know, be a power plant. Give me, you know, GDP growth every year, but give me a real chunky 9%, 10% dividend yield in the process, and a fairly stable. Again, when you have the crisis of 08, 09, electricity consumption goes down, but a little bit. It doesn't collapse like consumer demand and that sort of thing, or your consumers. And it gives you a much boring, but a stable sort of process of, in terms of income stream. So they have their place.
Yeah. And I think investors like the dividends coming out because you do get a little bit of the profits every time that they pay out the dividends. You don't have to wait until something maybe goes horribly wrong with the company and then you got nothing over the period. So getting that little bit of dividends every now and then is actually welcomed by investors.
Can you explain again, Simon? You explained to me once before how you can use your dividend payments to work out when you've paid back the share. The price of the share?
I think you're talking about PE, which is earnings. So I mean, in dividends, in essence, if you've got a 2% dividend yield, it's going to take 50 years for that 2% to pay back the share. But we were talking price earnings, which is a valuation ratio, which is the earnings per share, which is profit, divided into the share price. So if you've got a share that earns 2 Rand and the share price is 20 Rand, your PE is 10, which is 20 divided by 2, and that then says that it'll take 10 years of earnings of that company to equal the price that you've paid for the share, assuming no growth in earnings, which of course is not what we're going to assume.
So is this why we always look for companies that are undervalued? Because technically what that company, are you trying to get as close as possible to like one for that?
Sure, and except the few companies that I have seen that were one or then went bust. So no, not one. But no, but yes, what you do, so also it's strategy. So Zach mentioned the multi-factor approach, where the one strategy is momentum, right? So like, hey, the PE is 100, but who cares if it's going to 200? The other view, which is the sort of value, and value can be anything from, you know, Warren Buffett and Benjamin Graham on the other side to just, you know, DCFs and the like, discount cash flows. But I did it in the podcast last week, where you buy a share and you're going to profit it from it three ways. One is dividends. Two is increase in earnings per share. And two is the expansion of that price earnings. If I buy a share at a 5 price earnings and it expands to 10, just that expansion in price earnings doubles the share price. And then you get the earnings double, so you get another double in share price.
Yes, because I think sometimes people look at graphs of the S&P 500 or IT sector indices or even the JSE, and it seems to be going up and up and up, and it seems like it's becoming more expensive. Prices are going up and up. But if the earnings back up that price, then it actually is not becoming more expensive because there's earnings to back up why it is at that price.
It is more valuable. Right? It simply is making more profit, therefore more valuable, therefore higher share price.
All right, so before we wrap up, Sai, what is the thing you learned from our Listener Love Index?
What's the thing I learned from our Listener Love Index? That I love our listeners, but I don't want them to be my index maker. No, so I think this, I not something that I learned perhaps, but something which I was aware of, but which again got highlighted, was it was at around this point when Purple announced their deal with Sanlam. So Purple's in the news and there's loads of excitement, and it was our most picked stock with three picks.
Do you want to know who picked them?
No, shame. Or Charles. and it was 46 cents and now it's 25. And this is an old lesson, which is, you know, the hype and the excitement in the news is great, but the reality on the ground is probably going to play out a lot slower. And to the point being, which was it said, is that, you know, a year is a very short time.
So here's what I learned in my individual portfolio. Like, I never check it. Never, ever, ever. I like going in to buy my tax-free allocation every month because it brings me joy, kind of like buying shoes, but I never check my portfolio. And this is a portfolio that I checked every week, and it caused me pain every week.
And you didn't even have skin in the game.
I didn't even have skin in the game, and I just, like, I agree with Lisa Khisha as well. Like, this is why he gets to win all the time, because it's a short time period, and you shouldn't be poking at it all the time.
So what stock did you pick?
I didn't. I was going to pick the, I even said in that episode, if I were to pick one, I would have chosen the JSE. Which is up by 6.64%. So I didn't really cover myself in glory there.
Hey, you beat the index by, I mean, you're outperforming by almost 20% there.
So, like, officially 1 year in, we are 12.29% down in the index. What did the top 40 do over the last year?
Oh, sorry, I was looking for that and then I forgot to find it.
Let Zach tell us what he's learned from the Listener Love Index. Thank goodness he doesn't work for us.
Yeah, I think... I can't comment too much on that index, but I think some of the companies that investors typically loved when things became difficult and the economy is struggling is sort of the alcohol and tobacco companies. So,
classic defensive.
They go back to drinking and smoking when times are tough.
Fair enough.
And you can see that even the active managers portfolios that are quickly screened, is all seven of them were basically holding British American Tobacco as well. So that's one company that everybody seems to be loving during these difficult times.
So Satrix 40 as a benchmark did 1.6% over the last 12 months.
Wow, they really kicked our ass. This is the only time that the Satrix 40 can say they did amazing.
Hold on, while we got Zach here, let's look at the C top 50. That would be the fair representation.
I'm sure he's got it.
1 year it did 4.4. Okay. Lesson learned, hey?
Yes. More stocks, more diversification, and less single stock risk. Mm-hmm. Yes. I think the one thing that we can maybe compare the Love Index to, because there are so many small and mid caps in there, as well as maybe sort of a completion or a small cap index. And that struggle, that was down sort of...
What is this? What index is this? This is not a product yet.
No, it's not a product, but it's just S&P's version of mid and small caps. We call it a completion index for South Africa. So we have the top 50, which courses run, and then we have a mid and small cap index called the completion index.
So that would compete.
That would compete with a mid cap index or mid cap ETF, like what Ashburton has on the ground as well.
And that did?
Yeah, so that was negative. So
by how much?
So end of July, it was down almost 7%.
Man, it still beat us.
So unfortunately, the Ashburton mid-cap year-to-date, for the last 12 months, is down 7%.
What would have happened to our index if Purple Group wasn't on NASDAQ?
So you want me to remove Purple?
So just make it one instead of three.
Oh, interesting.
Maybe we should do that to all of the ones who got more love than the others and see where we would have ended up if we just had... 17 stocks.
For some reason, that didn't make any difference. Oh, I know why, because you want to drop that instead to 4.7. For some reason, it's not working on the fly.
I'd be interested to know.
So if we didn't make it and we dropped it down, we would have had 10 shares instead, and we would have been 15% down. How did that happen?
How are we worse off? Oh, no.
Because I'm fiddling with the wrong point. That's why. Okay, I won't actually change that index points as to... No, I'm not. It's not working. I don't know. Right. Somewhere my math is poor. No shame. Can't take purple out.
We won't take them out. I'm just wondering if we had 17 nominations, but some of them had a higher weighting than others.
Mm-hmm.
So we had 22 units in the end. I'm just curious to know what would have happened if we had only had.
So if we had done one of each and each. I can't do this on the fly.
Because purple is hurting us because it had a
because it was it was, it was 10%, which we capped it at. I remember that was a cap. We capped it at 10%, and it was down 45.
All right, so in truth, you should never smart beat a love.
So it's also kind of because then Steinhoff was down 96, but it's only 4.7. So in essence, they're almost the same.
Yeah. There we go, Cheapo. I hope you feel better now. She feels very guilty about her Steinhoff nomination, but I was like, you know what? Nobody saw it coming.
I'm not saying anything. Don't look at me.
Suspiciously quiet. All right, that's it from the Just One Lap team and from Zach Poseidonet this week. Thank you so much for joining us again. This is always such fun to do. I always learn so much. Please remember, this is a show about questions. We are running a little bit behind in the question department because we've had some guests, so that puts us back a little bit. You'll see an autoresponder, but we'll get to everybody eventually. Remember, please, to send your questions to ask@justonelap.com and then wait patiently until we get you. My name is Christopher Nealon. Thank you so much, Simon Brown. Thanks, Zach, for saying note. We'll catch you again next week.
Ciao, ciao. Thank you.